Good morning. Can you give me 1 second? We had some technical difficulties this morning, if you didn't notice. It's because I have an old computer. So it's going to take just a minute. Cool. All right, I'm calling an audible. Anyways, I don't know, a lot of you who have maybe developed a class or have done a lesson like this can probably relate to this. As I was going through this lesson that I've prepared, I didn't feel very good about it. I was going through and I couldn't really pinpoint maybe what was wrong, but I was just like, I don't know if I like this. And I've talked to my dad about things like this, and he said, you know, some of the lessons that I thought were the worst, other people thought were the best, and vice versa. And so, who knows what will happen. But, last night, I feel like I got a sign that maybe I shouldn't be doing this. As I am up here at the building, and I'm going over my lesson again, and just making sure that I've got everything, and the power goes out. And I don't know if you've ever been in a church building, especially a church building as large as this, by yourself with the power out, but it is frightening. I was sitting at my desk and I was like, what do I do? So I call Giff because I know he's awake. And I'm like, Giff, what do I do? Like, the power is out. Like, all the floodlights are on. I don't know what to do. And Giff's like, well, you could just leave. And I was like, but Giff, like, Giff, what if there's people here? And so I'm freaking out. Man, it was frightening. Like, I got home and I was like, Josh, listen to what just happened to me. Like, I don't know how I made it back. And so, if it doesn't go well, the universe told me not to preach this. So, we'll see how it goes. Recently, I've been given some life-changing advice. It's for any time I'm in a difficult or worrisome situation. And I'm pretty much, this is going to contradict what I just said, but I'm pretty much fearless because of this advice. I think I could walk into the ring with Mike Tyson right now and be fine. I could go into any job interview, I could watch any movie with jump scares and neither jump nor be scared, I'm pretty sure, because of this advice that I've received. Any situation that you could think of where one might be nervous or worried, I can walk into this situation with complete and absolute peace because of this advice. The advice is, if you're ever nervous, just simply don't be nervous. It's life-changing. And since hearing that, I've never been nervous again. That's absurd, right? I mean, I actually just said earlier I was scared to death last night because of the dark, pretty much. Now, obviously, this isn't true. And obviously, this statement, this if you're ever nervous, just simply don't be nervous, doesn't actually help at all. So why do I bring that up? With what we're talking about this morning, a lot of people will give advice such as that. This morning, we're going to talk about anxiety, stress, worry, and we're going to kind of use this word pressure to characterize all of these words. That way, every time I don't mention it, I have to say anxiety, stress, or worry. I'll just use the word pressure instead. People experience these feelings in overwhelming ways. And how are they often helped? Not all the time, but oftentimes, maybe something like this is heard. Just don't worry. Just trust God. And is that wrong? Absolutely not. That's absolutely what is expected of us. But it's the same as if your boss were to come to you and say, you could be doing your job better. Like, yes, that's probably true. I probably could be doing my job better in some way, but that's not very helpful at all. You're just telling me to do my job better. It's the expectation. We're supposed to be, as Christians, we're supposed to be able to fully submit and to trust God and to rely on Him and His will, but it doesn't really help us. The title of this lesson is In a World of Fatigue, God Sees. And I can't say that this is going to be a super practical lesson, and here's why. Everyone is different. Everyone struggles with different anxieties and issues, and everyone handles these things differently. Now, if you want specific strategies, I could go on the internet and look up how to overcome difficult stress, and I'll get take deep breaths, listen to soothing music, count to 10, things like that. There are some practical ways to do this, but this morning I want to talk about a way that we all, as Christians, as children of God, can overcome these issues, can overcome the pressures that we so often face. We're going to read a story this morning that's full of anxiety and stress and worry and fear, and all of these in large doses. And our goal is to determine what God expects of his people when enduring pressure, and learn from those in the story, both from their successes and their failures in dealing with this. And I have to give a disclaimer that I'm not discussing anxiety that is some medically diagnosed, that is a chemical imbalance, some sort of disorder. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm discussing feelings that are caused by uncertainty and stress and nervousness, things of that nature. I think there are two different kinds of pressures, two that we'll talk about this morning at least. And one is daily pressures. It's found in Matthew chapter 6, verses 25 through 33. Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount is giving qualifications as to what he expects from the people that are going to be in the kingdom of God. And so he talks about what these people are going to look like, those who are going to be in his kingdom, and how they're going to act, and what their relationship to God will be. So if you look with me, starting in verse 25, Jesus says, "For this reason I say to you, do not be worried about your life, as to what you will eat or what you will drink, nor for your body, as to what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing?" So Jesus gives us this statement, something that's very difficult to do. Do not be anxious. Do not worry. And again, that's one of those things that is expected of us, but just this verse alone is not incredibly helpful. However, we do learn some things from it. One is that pressure can be overcome because Jesus expects it of us. The fact that Jesus said this in the first place tells us that we can overcome anxiety and stress and worry. Also, though this isn't a command to never experience these feelings, as the feeling of anxiety or the feeling of stress is a feeling. It's something that can be good, but it often can also be detrimental. What Jesus is telling us is that we are not to be ruled by anxiety or worry or fear. If you continue on in verses 26 through 31, Jesus says, "Look at the birds of the air, that they do not sow, nor reap, nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth much more than they? And who of you, by being worried, can add a single hour to his life? And why are you worried about clothing? Observe how the lilies of the field grow. They do not toil, nor do they spin. Yet I say to you that not even Solomon in all his glory clothed himself like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today, and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? Do not worry then, saying, what will we eat, or what will we drink, or what will we wear for clothing?" So Jesus goes on and he tells us all these reasons why people that are children of God should not worry about these daily anxieties, these daily pressures that we face. He talks about how much God cares for things that are worth so much less than humans, and says, if God cares for these things, why are you worried? You of much more value. And he closes this thought in verses 32 and 33 by saying, "For the Gentiles eagerly seek all these things, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." He says, even the Gentiles seek after these things. Everyone needs clothing and food. Everyone needs these things, and God knows that. But Jesus gives a solution. Seek first God's kingdom, and all these daily pressures and all these daily anxieties that we face will be fulfilled. And that's why there's no reason for a child of God to worry about them. Now, God's not saying we're always going to have always going to be the wealthiest and have the nicest of clothes and the tastiest of foods to eat. That's not at all what he's saying, but he is saying that he takes care of his people. The second kind of pressure is a circumstantial pressure. And this is where we'll be the rest of the morning in verses in chapter 16 and chapter 21, talking about the story of Abram, Sarai, and Hagar. A circumstantial pressure is a pressure that is caused by an event, something, some sort of death or traumatic experience, some sort of violence, or maybe it's just a lot of stress because of a particular situation or circumstance. This is the kind of pressure that we see from pretty much every character involved in this rather messy instance found in the Bible. To give a quick recap of the lives of Abram and Sarai before we get to this point in chapter 16, we see some important things. In chapter 12, God calls out to Abram while he is 75 years old and says, I want you to leave your homeland of Haran and move to a land that I will show you. So in an incredible act of faith, Abram, at 75, leaves his home and obeys the will of God and goes wherever God leads him. And it's worth noting that because of his willingness to completely submit to God, we don't really read of Abraham or Abram worrying about daily anxieties. Abram is quite literally a follower of God. And while we're about to study a time when Abram experiences a lot of circumstantial pressures, it is important to point out that he doesn't really experience these daily pressures because God is taking care of him. Later on, he travels into the country of Egypt because of a famine. And as he goes through, he's worried because his wife Sarai is very beautiful, and he's worried that the Pharaoh will kill him and take Sarai to be his own wife. And so he says, how about we just say we're brother and sister? Terrible idea. Pharaoh thinks, oh, if they're just brother and sister, then I can take Sarai to be my wife. Takes Sarai to be his wife in exchange for cattle and oxen and male and female servants. Well, this is obviously not part of God's plan. It's not part of his will. And so he sends down plagues upon Pharaoh and the Egyptians to get them to give back Sarai. And so Pharaoh somehow figures out, oh, maybe this is happening because I have this man's wife and I didn't know it. And so he gives Sarai back to Abram, upset because of Abram's dishonesty. Honesty was something that was very important in the culture of the Egyptians during this time. And so they're very upset about this. Then in chapter 15 is the promise of Abraham. God promises Abram a son who will be his heir and his offspring. And his offspring will be as many as the stars in the sky, too many to count. And not only that, but this offspring that he will have will dwell in Canaan, the promised land. And that leads us into chapter 16. Some time has passed since the promise was made to him. We don't exactly know how much time. We know that it was between when Abram was 75, when God called him, and 85, because he was 85 in chapter 16, verse 3. So at the very beginning of chapter 16, it talks about Abram being 85. So there's a 10-year span. Somewhere in this 10 years, probably toward the latter half, Abram is promised by God that he will have a son. So no matter how much time it is, Abram and Sarai are patiently waiting for this wonderful blessing of a little boy. And the issue is that Sarai is barren. The anxiety of not knowing the future eventually overcomes Sarai. And so she decides that they must do something in order to make this happen, for their son to be had. And that's when Hagar is introduced. In chapter 16, verse 1, she's an Egyptian servant of Sarai's. And I would think that it's likely that Hagar was picked up during that whole debacle with Pharaoh, where Pharaoh gives Abram the male and the female servants and the oxen and whatnot, and then gives Sarai back. I would think that that is probably when Hagar got picked up. So in verse 2, Sarai makes the proposal that Abram has the child with Hagar so that the son could be had, and Abram agrees. And at this point, all that they know, Abram and Sarai, is that the son is going to come from Abram. So this is their solution to making sure that God's promise comes true. The problem is that God doesn't need man to ensure that his promises are fulfilled. Their own anxiety surrounding the situation that they have been presented with causes Sarai to make an impatient and rash decision that was customary of the Assyrians, but not something that was condoned by God. The Lord gave them this amazing promise. It was supposed to be a blessing, a son that would be a great nation. And this blessing should have brought peace to Abram, knowing that God was going to continually care for him and his family for generations. And yet, Abram and Sarai allowed this to cause them pressure. One of the greatest blessings that they were ever to receive became a cause for stress, and it's not because of the blessing itself or anything that God did, but instead them lacking in trust and not understanding God's will and his timing. And there's a lesson to be learned there, right off the bat. It seems like so often our anxieties are caused by ourselves, just not submitting to God's will. A job is a blessing. However, we can also allow ourselves to get caught up in a job, the expectations of the job, the amount of work that we have to do, etc., and lose sight of the blessing that our job is. Abram and Sarah received a promise that was amazing. But the anxiety surrounding the uncertainty of how it was going to happen caused them to make a decision that was against God's will. So, Sarai's request is done, to no objection of Abram. And Sarai was angry because it says that she was then despised in Hagar's sight. So this means that Hagar thought of Sarai as less. Not so much Hagar thinking of herself as equal with Sarai, but more so Hagar saw Sarai more on her level, brought Sarai down, and this irks Sarai. She hates it. So this takes us into verse 5 of chapter 16. And Sarai said to Abram, "May the wrong done me be upon you. I gave my maid into your arms, but when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her sight. May the Lord judge between you and me." Now, I read this verse multiple times. I didn't really know what it meant. And I genuinely knew, like, okay, Sarai is upset here. And I genuinely know why. But there are some phrases in there I didn't quite understand. So me, being the wise 21-year-old that I am, knowing that I don't know everything, I was thinking, maybe I could talk to someone who's married about what is really happening here. Conveniently, Dr. Seth Camp is right across the hall from my office. So I walk into Billy's office and I say, "Billy, can we read chapter 16, verse 5 together and maybe like talk out what is happening here? Tell me, you know, from your standpoint, what do you think is happening?" And this is what he said. "Abram shouldn't have done what Sarai proposed, even though Sarai proposed it. Now, Abram had the choice, and Sarai approved it, and then Abram did it," which in Abram's eyes, he had the clearance. Sounds like a good idea to him. It works. And Sarai is still mad. He shouldn't have done it. He used the example of if a husband is to ask his wife, "Can I go hang out with my friends tonight?" She's like, "Yeah, of course. Go hang out with your friends. That sounds great." And then he goes and hangs out with his friends and comes back home. And she's like, "Why'd you go hang out with your friends? You could have been hanging out with me." And it's confusing. I don't know what this is like. I don't know about these things. But apparently Billy has had some experience in this. And so he imparted this wisdom upon me. And I think that that's right. And I think that's what has happened. So Sarah knows that Hagar thinks less of her. And Hagar hates her for it. Sarai hates her for it. She tells Abram of her concerns in a very strongly worded exchange, and Abram says, "Do what you want. This is your maidservant." He pretty much relieves himself of any form of accountability that he could possibly take, and suddenly the woman that is holding the child of promise, what they thought was going to be the child of promise, isn't quite as important. Sarai deals harshly with her, is what it says, and Hagar, being pregnant, escapes. That takes us into verses 7 and 8. "Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. He said, 'Hagar, Sarah's maid, where have you come from and where are you going?' And she said, 'I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress, Sarai.'" So Hagar is found in the wilderness by a spring when God speaks to her through an angel. She's likely headed back to Egypt, where she's from. But for what? She's a pregnant servant with nobody to take care of her. She's free from Sarai now, but she's hopeless. Whatever Sarai was doing, it must have been pretty bad for Hagar to be willing to leave this job. Like, she's working for a man of God who is, he takes care of her, and he's relatively wealthy, and she has a baby that she can't support on her own. But in her mind, it was better for her to leave the situation that she was in and go off into the wilderness than to stay and be dealt harshly by Sarai, whatever was happening there. She's facing a time where anxiety must be at a high. She doesn't know what's in store for her future. She doesn't know where her next meal is going to come from or how long she and her baby that she didn't ask for will survive. This has to be an incredibly stressful time full of pressure. But I want to note a couple of things. First, in verse 7, it says that the angel of the Lord found her. I thought the word "found" was interesting. It doesn't say that the angel of the Lord appeared to her randomly or that the angel of the Lord was walking down the path and was like, "Oh, there's Hagar." It says that the angel of the Lord found her. God was searching for her in this time of need. In a time when nobody wants Hagar, nobody really cares about her, God shows that he cares. And then in verse 8, he said, "Hagar, Sarai's maid, where have you come from and where are you going?" God knows her. He knows her name. But she doesn't know God. Think about this. Hagar is an Egyptian woman. And the only time that it's recorded that she has any form of interaction with God is during the plagues upon Pharaoh. And that's probably all that she really knows about the God of Abraham. She doesn't know the God of Abraham, but the God of Abraham knows her. Read with me in verses 9 through 12. "Then the angel of the Lord said to her, 'Return to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority.' Moreover, the angel of the Lord said to her, 'I will greatly multiply your descendants so that they will be too many to count.' The angel of the Lord said to her further, 'Behold, you are with child, and you will bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. He will be a wild donkey of a man, his hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him, and he will live to the east of all of his brothers.'" So Hagar is told to return and submit to Sarai, revoking the freedom that she has just gained, but she's also promised by God that her descendants will also be too many to count, much like the promise given to Abraham. She will have a son named Ishmael. The name means God hears, because God heard Hagar during this time of need. Read with me in verses 13 through 14. "Then she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, 'You are a God who sees.' For she said, 'Have I even remained alive here after seeing him?' Therefore the well was called Beer Lahai Roy. Behold, it is between Kadesh and Bered." Hagar knows nothing of the God of Abraham. This is her first real interaction that she's ever had with him. She thought she was dead in verse 13, saying, "Have I remained alive after seeing him?" The gods that she's used to in Egypt are not personal gods. They're not going to seek her out and find her. They're not going to talk to her. This is all new for Hagar. And the first observation that she makes about the God of Abraham is that God sees. The well, Beer Lahai Roy. It means well of the living one who sees me. And Hagar now has come into contact with the God who lives, the only one who lives, and he sees. And there's something for us to learn there. Our God, the God of Abraham, the God that we serve that is found in this story, he is alive and he sees us. Hagar is experiencing huge amounts of pressure and anxiety and not knowing at all what her future holds, but God saw her, he found her. The God that we serve sees us, and he knows the anxieties and things that we're going through that plague us. What does he say to do about that? In Psalm chapter 55, verse 2, it says, "Cast your burdens on the Lord, and he will sustain you." Philippians chapter 4, verses 4 through 7 says, "Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Let your reasonableness be known to everyone. The Lord is at hand. Do not be anxious about anything. But in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 7 says, "Casting all your anxieties on him because he cares for you." Those who are children of God can cast our burdens on him through prayer, knowing that he will sustain us and that he will give us a peace that is greater than any understanding that man could possibly possess, because he cares for us. Sometimes when experiencing anxiousness and worry, it's helpful just to talk to someone who listens. I think that's one of the greatest compliments that you can receive, is that you're a good listener, because not many people are. It takes knowing you have to care about what's being said, and you have to show that you care. And that's a great quality to have. And there's a lot of people here sitting to your right and left that are willing to listen to you as brothers and sisters in Christ. But may we never forget that the God that we serve listens, and he is active, and he sees you. So we'll move on to chapter 21, just a few flips over. Hagar returns to Abram and Sarah. He has Ishmael when Abram is 86 years old, and they continue on. Abraham and Sarah finally have Isaac, and that's discussed in the first 8 verses of chapter 21. All of the worry for their future is relieved. But I think that Sarai still has some pent-up anger towards Hagar, and it's seen in how angry she is when Ishmael mocks Isaac. It says that Ishmael, who is about 14 years old, mocks Isaac, who is about 2 to 3 years old. And I think of just this 14-year-old boy, I don't know, just playing around, maybe making fun of this little kid. Really not something that's a big deal, I would think. And Sarah just gets so upset about it. She's so angry to the point that she wants to kick both Hagar and Ishmael out because of Ishmael's actions. So she goes to Abraham about this, and Abraham is hesitant because this is his first son. But God tells him to obey Sarah and trust that God will take care of them both. So Abraham arises early the next morning. He obeys God with haste, brings them some supplies, and sends them on their way into the wilderness. And that takes us into verse 15. When the water in the skin was used up, she left the boy under one of the bushes. Then she went and sat down opposite him, about a bow shot away. For she said, "Do not let me see the boy die." And she sat opposite him and lifted up her voice and wept. The supplies are used up. They're in Beersheba, which is a place that really doesn't have very much water. And Hagar is in a very similar situation to what she was just a few chapters ago, except this time her son is born. This mother, Hagar, had to leave her 14, 15-year-old boy under this bush, knowing that he was dehydrated and that he was going to die, and she walked far away from it. Think about that walk. That's something that I had not noticed until I was preparing for this, that she was thinking during the walk, right? And some of you who are parents can probably think of maybe some possible things that she was thinking of better than I, but some things come to mind for me as well. Maybe what are some thoughts that crossed her mind as she was making this walk away from her son for what she thinks is the last time? But one thing that I think that she thought of was maybe what happened last time she was stranded in the wilderness. And I think that because of what she does. She doesn't know how to reach out to God. She doesn't exactly know what to say or what to do. She just has faith that he sees and that he hears. So she utters one of the first prayers recorded in the Bible, "Do not let me see the boy die." She doesn't call the gods that she knows, but instead the God that knows her. Read with me in verses 17 and 18. God heard the lad crying, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What is the matter with you, Hagar? Do not fear, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him by the hand, for I will make a great nation of him." Have you noticed that nobody has used Hagar's name except the narrator and God? Abraham and Sarah, they never said or called her by name. They always said, "Your maid servant, the Egyptian woman, your maid," and never Hagar. But God has called her name twice. God knows Hagar. And this time he hears her son, who again, his name means God hears, crying in his time of need. He tells Hagar, "Fear not. God's already promised that she would have offspring that were too many to count. So why worry?" And then later in that verse, it says that God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. And where he is under a bush, about to die, knowing that he's about to die. He's crying. And God hears Ishmael. One thing about struggling with anxiety is that it can weigh you down to the point where just lifting up your foot and taking another step is difficult. In Proverbs chapter 12, verse 25, it says, "Anxiety in a man's heart weighs him down, but a good word makes him glad." And in times when taking each step becomes more and more difficult, God hears you where you are, and he answers. Now notice, the first time Hagar was stranded, she made the claim that God is a God who sees. But in this instance, the God who sees is the one who opens the eyes of Hagar. Read with me in verse 19. "Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink." The well could have already been there, and Hagar just didn't see it because of the stress and the anxiety that she was under. Or God could have done something supernatural and the well just appeared. But regardless, we learn that there was a way for God to care for them. And maybe he was just waiting for Hagar to call out to him. maybe waiting for Ishmael to call. If your life is full of pressures and burdens right now, maybe you really relate to the description that I gave of someone who is struggling with each step, trudging along through life, burdened by anxieties and worries. There is someone who is willing to bear that for you. I think back to the verse we just read in Psalms chapter 55, verse 2. He will sustain you if you cast your burdens on Him. God has a plan for you and a way to give you the peace that you so desperately desire, that we all want and need, but maybe He's waiting for you to call on Him. Completely submit yourself to Him and cast your burdens upon the One who can truly carry them all. He'll meet you where you are, listening and understanding better than anyone else can, but He could just be waiting on you. Maybe your eyes aren't opened to what God has in front of you because of that stress and anxiety that you're facing. It makes me think of the other day. We were loading in the warehouse, and Mr. Doug Schofield, who I know and love, asked me to find the hammer. He said, "We need this hammer. It's by your left foot." However, and I've been like this since I was a kid, if I needed the hammer and I thought, "I need to go get a hammer," I could have found it immediately. But because he asked me to find this hammer, I was like, "Oh no, where's the hammer? Oh, hammer." And I'm like looking around, and it takes me probably a whole minute to find the hammer that's right beside my foot. Even with him telling me, the hammer's right beside your foot. Why is this? I don't necessarily know. But I think it's because I start frantically searching. I get nervous because Mr. Doug is a very respectable man, and I want to please him. I want to get the hammer as fast as I can so that he's not having to wait on me. Maybe it's because I don't want to look unintelligent and not be able to find this hammer when it's right beside me. Regardless, it was almost as if it was hidden to me. The hammer was right by my foot the whole time. But because I was so frantically searching and all of these thoughts and worries were coming in my head other than, "You should just get that hammer," I couldn't see the hammer. The answer, the open door, the peace that is needed to move on from the fatigue caused by constant worry, maybe it's there the whole time. What if you just need your eyes opened to the remedy that God has provided? God has seen you. He sees you now. And He has a plan for you that does not involve worry or anxiety, but rather someone whose burdens are lifted and whose worries are dissolved by the peace that surpasses all understanding through prayer. So, here's some advice. If this is something that you struggle with, if you feel burdened or anxious or worried or stressed, go to the throne of grace with boldness, knowing that you serve a God who is alive and who is listening to you always. Cast your burdens on God. Pray to Him. Be honest with Him. Approach His throne with boldness and don't allow the pressures and the anxieties of this world to overcome you. We serve a God who is alive and He is listening. If you don't serve our God, maybe you relate to Hagar in this, an Egyptian woman who really doesn't know the God of Abraham. He loves you. And now is a better time than ever to begin serving Him. Maybe you relate more to Abraham and Sarah, who knows God, but they allow this anxiety and these burdens to distract them from what is most important, and that is fulfilling God's will. If you have a need of any kind this morning, if you're sitting in the pew and your shoulders are tense and you've been thinking, maybe this lesson has reminded you of all of the things that you are worried about and anxious about, let us pray for you and with you. As brothers and sisters, let us approach the throne of grace with boldness together. If you have a need of any kind, please come forward as